medieval festival. And there they are. I think I should go back to the King James if I can find a version around here. So we can get into the mood of it. Yesterday, we began by setting the stage a little bit, and maybe there are a few of you who were not here yesterday, so I'll backtrack a little. And we talked about the story part of Job, that is, the Job who is the hero, the perfect man, the one who is set up to be, as it were, the foil for the reality of life and the agony of life. The Job is going to spell out today and in the subsequent chapters. The ideal man, as we portrayed him, was the one who had everything and then lost everything. The one who was the perfect, pious individual, as well as the man who had all property and a perfect family, and all of those things which we think are just exactly the way we want it in a bourgeois, middle class, or upper class society. And all of these things are stripped from him, including, in the end, any kind of physical comfort. And so he lives only with his soul and his God in total agony. And at that point, he is still saying, thanks God for being so nasty to me. Thanks God for all of the crud and everything else. Blessed be the Lord who gives, and so on. Now, another word of background that we mentioned was that this is part of what we call wisdom literature. That is the kind of literature that looks at man's relationship with God and with nature from a slightly different perspective than the kind of material that is in much of the Old Testament, namely the material of the plan of salvation of history, where God intervenes and liberates and rescues his people through specific acts in history at crucial times. And that kind of theology is the basic central motif upon which Bill Cohn and others are basing their theology of liberation. It is usually seen to be central. However, there are other themes that are important, and I think for many of us who are rich whites, the answer to an understanding of life is also meaningful in terms of the burden of being people with possessions, the burden of being the people who are supposed to face God with all that we have, and the potential and the possibility of losing all of that in the face of really meeting God in our soul encounter with him. Wisdom literature talks about none of those things like the Exodus, says nothing about the worship of Israel, says nothing about the mighty acts of God rescuing Israel in the wilderness or giving them the promised land. None of those things are at all involved in the major works of wisdom literature. Rather, they talk about man as he is, man in his relationship to nature, man over against other men and women. And to some extent, wisdom literature is written by men. In fact, almost all books of the Bible are written by men, which is a part of the problem. And God is a man, too, which is part of the problem. We have, in a certain sense, a one-sided picture of God in the monotheism. Just a couple more examples of the nature of the material in wisdom literature, some of which one might want to indict because it is somewhat one-sided. In fact, it's probably written by rich whites, excepting probably Job. And yet, there's a perspective in wisdom literature that says that man should be concerned, every man should be concerned with every other man in the same way. Let me just give you a couple of examples of wisdom literature for those who are fresh again, and then we'll have it in our mind. Wisdom literature talks about everyday things. For example, one text, it is better to live in the corner of a brewery than to live with a nagging wife. Now, that's down to earth and every day. You'll find many such portraits that run through the... Or he who grabs a passing dog by the ears is a fool. Many such wise statements like that that grow out of human experience. Very, very down-to-earth kind of things. Or a little bit more significant, let me take Proverbs 22:22 and following. Actually, there's a lot of irony and satire and humor running all the way through it. which we don't catch if we come at it with the kind of piety we traditionally do. We read it, you know, if somebody gets up to preach, the text for today is, dead flies make the ointment to stink, you know, and doesn't quite come off. Proverbs 22, verses 22 and following, however, reflect a somewhat more significant 22, verses 22 and following. Never rob a helpless man because he is helpless, nor ill-treat a poor wretch in court, for the Lord will take up their cause and rob him who robs them of their livelihood. Or in other places, he who oppresses a poor man insults his maker. On the basis of the fact that man was made by God and man is, in a sense, in the image of God, every man is the reflection of God and ought to be treated in that way as God's man. We are all God's men, to be treated the same. And there are fascinating little reflections of this whole problem of man who is the oppressed one and God who is the one who will take up the cause of the oppressed. Not in the language of history, but in the language of everyday court and everyday living and everyday agony. Those are the kind of things that you'll find in wisdom literature. Now what Job does is to take that whole picture and give it all kinds of new twists as he himself goes through the agony of being totally oppressed. But the oppressor, he says, is God. And that's where the twist is. That's where the dilemma is. Job is the slave and God is the taskmaster. If that be the case, why was I born? That's essentially the theme of the first chapters. Now, to understand some of these cries of agony, which really come out very violently and vehemently, you really ought to look at some of the introits and collects that are in our church. It bothers me when we just sing them and say them without any kind of context, like, blessed are they, O Lord, who smashed the little ones against the rocks. There's something a little awkward about that, without a context, you see. All these prayers that cry damnation on the enemy without any kind of an awareness of where the background is of these what we call imprecatory psalms. That is, you call down an imprecation, an imprecatory cry of vengeance against your enemies. And we have many of those psalms in the book of Psalms. Most of them are not in our hymnal collections, which is possibly fortunate. And yet we have used them. Luther used them against the Turks, and people have used them over the generations. It is striking, as Bill Cohn said last night, that they were not used against the white slave master. Very striking. They are used by generations all the time against the enemy. And the Israelite used them against his enemy. Let me just read a couple of these. They are, in a certain sense, hard to swallow because they are violent and vigorous. Psalm 69 is one. Let me just pick out a couple of these. Psalm 69, first of all, the cry is in agony. I sink in muddy waters and have no foothold. I am swept away in deep water and the flood carries me away. I am weary with crying. My throat is sore. Then the cry for help, rescue me from the mire. Let me be rescued from the muddy pits. But the cry is really not just that he wants to be rescued. If you read it through, you will find that he asks also that he will be, that the enemy will be destroyed, that those who bother him and persecute him will be given God's vengeance. Thou knowest what reproaches I bear. All my anguish is seen by you, God. Reproach has broken my heart. My shame and my dishonor are past hope. I've looked for consolation. Nothing came. They put poison in my food and gave me vinegar when I was thirsty. May their table be a snare to them and their sacred feast lure them to their own ruin. May their eyes be darkened so they do not see. Let a continual ague shake their loins. Pour out thine indignation
upon them, and let thy burning anger overtake them. Make all their desolations, all their settlements desolate, and no one living in their tents, for they pursue him whom thou hast struck down, and multiply the torments of those whom thou hast wounded. Give them the punishment their sin deserves, God. Exclude them. Exclude them from your mercy. Those kind of cries for vengeance are not isolated. They run quite frequently through the Psalms. What happens in the book of Job is not that Job cries out against other enemies who are persecuting him, but that he cries out against God. God is the one who is his primary oppressor. Let me mention one little anecdote before I actually look at the text with you. It's the one that I mentioned already in the worship service last week, and some of you may remember it. When I was a boy, we had a fire. My brother and I were playing tennis at the time. We had a phone call saying your house is on fire, and we stormed back home in our little utility truck, something like 95 miles an hour. We got home and the place was just one massive blaze, and there was nothing we could do, and we lost absolutely every possession that we had. All we had were our tennis shorts. Next day we went to church with borrowed clothes on, a motley crew. But as we stood there with the fire all around, with the fire burning, the people began to gather. They seemed to come out of the woodwork, out of nowhere. We were way out in the country in the bush, and yet there were people coming. The fire drew them. And the pastor came, too, sort of wandering to and fro on the earth. He came. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Norm, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Well, those words made quite an impression on me. I felt like clobbering him. Now, I was a boy then. Now, 20 years later now, I would have very different reaction to those words. I would clobber him. Because when all is said and done, that kind of pious answer of the tradition, you know, you say the nice things, and there's absolutely no understanding of what it's like to lose absolutely everything, and to be standing there with your gut hanging out and somebody then patting and saying, it's nice, God did it. Of course he did, but I wanted to scream bloody murder at God, and that's exactly the way that Job reacts after you've set up the foil, and the real Job comes out in the next chapter, which is chapter 3, and he begins by saying, damn the day I was born. Now, of course, we translate these things very nicely, too, lest we offend people. We have a problem with piety even amongst the translators, you see. All through the Bible, we are always toning things down or using euphemisms so that you don't hear the real gut cries of the men of God, whom you can identify with because indeed they say it as it is. And Job says it, damn the day that I was born. And he virtually damns everything excepting God. And he wishes that God would damn him to get rid of him. And then God would look everywhere and he couldn't find Job, and Job would be able to laugh in God's face because he would have died and have vanished in Sheol in the underworld. Listen to that chapter, a few verses. Maybe there are a few questions before I move into the actual text here. Interrupt me if you do, if I say something you don't follow. I think in a certain sense, Job, a Bible study in Job can only be a feeling kind of thing. You can't sort of go verse by verse and analyze it. You just have to feel it, if you can, as I read the sections and make my comments. One other prior comment. If you've read the book by Kubler-Ross on the five stages of dying, you will find that in many ways it is an insight into human life that is helpful for reading
books like Job. The five stages are, first of all, a denial and saying, why me? It really didn't happen. Won't admit that you have died. The second stage is anger. Third stage is some kind of bargaining with God. The fourth one is total depression. And the fifth one is finally resignation. And Job is really about dying. Job is dying, but dying spiritually as well as physically. And he has to die, of course, if he's ever going to really discover God. He has to die. And I think that's true for us. And the stages of dying that are in Job are similar, but yet with certain interesting twists. He hardly has time to say, why, you know, should it be me? He gets into his anger very quickly. And instead of bargaining with God, he challenges God. And in the end, the question is, does he resign himself to it? Or does his whole play at the end of the book point to a rather ironic twist as to how you live with God and what kind of God really is? I'm not going to give you what I think the answer to the book is. I'm going to let you stew about that a little bit. Wouldn't be fair. Listen to chapter 3. The beginning of his anger and the fading away of the first stages, namely the rejecting that it could possibly be me. Damn the day when I was born. Damn the night when they said a man is conceived. May that day turn to darkness. May God not look for it, nor light shine on it. As you go through that first chapter, darkness becomes the desirable thing. And if you ever get to that point where life is totally one of agony, the crawling away into the corner of darkness, the escaping from everything that suggests that you have to reach out, someone or something, every little bit of light is ugly. And death becomes the most desirable thing. Or he says, why should I not be stillborn? Why was I born at all? If life is nothing but woe. Why did I not die when I came out of the womb? I remember going once to visit a girl in the asylum in St. Louis, or in the hospital. And she had snuck a letter out. They weren't supposed to write to anybody. She'd gotten this letter out to me. And I went, and they said I could see her. And she said, I don't want to live, and I don't want to die. There's only one solution to life. And I couldn't imagine any other alternative. And she says that I had never been born. And from that moment, I began to understand the book of Job, the total mental and psychological anguish of this man. Why should I have been born? Why was I privileged to have breasts to suck and to cuddle, he says? Why wasn't I simply an abortion? That would have been better than living the way I have to live. Why wasn't I an abortion? Now, the language again is nicely tamed in the English text. For he says, then I would have been in the grave now. And that's where there's rest. Rest from the oppression of God. There's an interesting little note here which ties in with what we've been saying. There in the grave there's no more oppression by the wicked man. There the laborer has rest. There you don't hear the slave master's voice anymore. High and low are there, and even the slave free from his master. That's the place. Death is the one place where I can be free. Free from God, and this is the thing that he is struggling with. That God has put his finger on him and won't let him go, and he keeps forcing him to die and die and die and never really end it. Now the question is not merely that he is suffering, that he's lost all of his family and all of his friends and
everything else, and that he's got boils all over his body. That's really only secondary to the bigger question that's right in here. The bigger question, why should there be a life of suffering at all? Why is life given to a man if life is going to be nothing but bitterness? If there is no freedom, why give man life if you don't give him freedom, God? Or putting it another way, why do you hide a man's way? Now, if you read a little bit of Old Testament, you'll find out that the word way means destiny, future, purpose, meaning. Everyone has his own way. That means his destiny, if you will. How come you give a man a destiny and then block it? Hedge it in is the word. You're the one that's hedged it in. The problem is not that he has no property or that he has no family, that he has all these boils. The problem is God. God won't free him to have his own destiny. And that's damnable. To live without a future, without a purpose. That's dying. That's really dying. And Job is going through that, of trying to find any kind of purpose at all, any kind of meaning in this life of oppression under God. How do you move from that? I've got no peace. I've got no rest. I've got no ease. Only torment. That's the way the chapter ends. And he gets three friends. The three friends have a series of ways of handling his problem. Rather like three doctors who will analyze your sickness rather detachedly, or three theologians who may do it the same way. And the three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, have several different ways of handling this crumpled heap of crud there called Job. How do we handle him? Well, Eliphaz comes back, and he's the first one to answer after this cry of agony. And his answer is an answer that you've heard many times. Well, anybody who is in that shape, with all those boils and with having lost all of those things, there's only one thing that could be wrong with him. He must be guilty. I mean, he's done something wrong. Now, how many times haven't we heard that, even felt it? Did I lose my child because I did something to deserve it? My sister went through that. Great agony. She lost her first child. The potential guilt that's there in the background. And I don't know where she got it, outside of getting it from the church. And that's the pain of it all. Eliphaz says, well, listen now, consider. He says, consider. What innocent man ever perished? So you've got to be guilty. We're all guilty somewhere. It's got to be guilt. What else is there? Where have you ever seen the upright destroyed? This I know, that those who plow mischief and sow trouble will certainly reap the blast of God. Or he puts it a little more bluntly a little later on. He says, consider, can a mortal man be righteous before God, in verse 17? Can the creature be pure with his maker? God doesn't even trust his angels, he says. Nothing is clean when you compare it to God, he says. So clearly you must be the sinner. And the reason why you're there is that you've been cursed by God. Now, there's a good old doctrine that was running around in the days of Deuteronomy and maybe as early as Moses. And people put it very plainly, if you do the right thing and you obey the commandments of God, the 10 words of God, you will be blessed and you'll get the promised land and a lot of other things. And if you do bad things, like picking up sticks on the Sabbath or adultery, which are put on the same level in some texts, if you do evil things, then you will be punished. You'll be put under the curse. But the trouble was that many people reversed that and said, well, look, you're under the curse. You've been punished. You're suffering for some reason, therefore you must have done something wrong. That guy's blessed for some reason, therefore he must have done something good. Now Job is saying it just doesn't work that way. I haven't done anything to deserve this. Of course, Eliphaz says you must have. That's the doctrine. I mean, that's the way it is. We've been taught that way. The doctrine is clear and the doctrine is true. You cannot challenge doctrine or tradition. So the three theologians sit beside him and they have the answers. Or another answer that Eliphaz has is, we can also think it might be discipline. You really need to be disciplined, Job. The discipline of suffering. Happy is the man whom the Lord rebukes. Therefore, do not reject the discipline of the Almighty. Of course, we have to say bulldust in the case of Job. It is just not the way it is. Job is set up. You know he's set up as the perfect man. And this is the man who's going through this. Eliphaz all sorts of nice sayings. You may invite disaster 6 times, but he'll always save you on the 7th. There's always assurance that God will ultimately pull you out of it, and you needn't worry. The answers of the three men are very clearly the kind of answers that you will hear from your church, and I heard from my pastor. Eliphaz is one. Let me just take another one. Bildad says, just think about the doctrine for a while. Inquire now, he says, of the older generations, chapter 8, verse 8, those who are following. And consider the experience of the fathers. Now, we've got a long line of experience of all these old men who died of old age and did good things, and they'll tell you that there's a clear answer. Verse 13, the fate of the wicked is clear. If they forget God, the godless man's life breaks off like a thread, and if he's lush in even the sun, he will be torn out and ripped out by the roots and so on. But the righteous man will prosper ultimately. In the end, there may be a slight delay, you know, like 95 years, but it'll happen. The wicked will eventually get it in the neck. Be sure, he says, God will not spurn the blameless man. He goes through the whole tradition thing again. In fact, he uses a formula of appeal to tradition that we know of. The third of these wise men is in chapter 11, a man by the name of Zophar. Zophar, the words of our text, as somebody said once. Zophar. The answer of Zophar is no longer tradition so much as another way of looking at it that you've heard and I've heard too. It's really a mystery, Job. And mysteries really help when you're in agony. Listen, if only God could tell you and open his lips to talk with you in 11 verse 5 and expound to you the secrets of wisdom. Know that the Lord exacts from you less than your sin deserves. That's really helpful. Can you fathom the mystery of God, he says? Can you understand the perfection of the Almighty? It's higher than heaven. You can know nothing. It's deeper than Sheol. The answer to all of it is to realize, he says, that somehow there's a mystery, there's a dimension of God that brings this suffering, and you can't understand it but accept it because obviously it's from God and therefore it must be good. It's a mystery. Those are the three answers, the answer of discipline and of doctrine and of guilt and of the mystery of God. There are variations on those, but those are the three answers, essentially, or was it four, that are given. How can Job handle those? Job handles them not with any kind of reflection, as any man who is in agony does. He does not reflect so much as he exudes from a gut level exactly what he's going through. And what Job is going through is spelled out very clearly in several chapters. Let me backtrack on a couple of Job's cries for a moment.
Chapter 7, and I'm using some of the themes that tie in with what we've been saying precisely from Job. There are a lot of other themes too. In chapter 7, Job says, "Has not man hard labor on earth? Are not his days like those of a slave? Like those of a slave longing for the shade, or a servant kept waiting and waiting for his wages. So the month of futility are my portion, troubled my lot. When I lie down, I think, when will it be day that I can rise up? And when the evening grows long and I lie down, I do nothing but toss till morning twilight." And then Job goes about the business of reminding God of agony. "God, do you know what it's like to be in agony?" And in a certain sense, there are other parts of the Old Testament where God truly does go through agony. And the agony of God is a very important theme. Job, as it were, throws his agony in the face of God to sort of force God to see it and feel it. One of our problems is that we are not honest, we are not willing and ready to scream to God when we are in agony, to scream at God. And the part of the point of Job is the honesty against a kind of false piety. It says we must say nice things to God. "God, please help me." What Job does is to portray in all of its gruesomeness how he feels before God. He lets it out. The catharsis of total honest screaming to God for what he goes through. Now, there are, it's very difficult to do that in most of our worship services with the kind of liturgy we possess. But it can certainly happen in other contexts if you cannot do it there. That if that's the way you are, if you are at one of the stages of dying in your spiritual life, that you permit those kind of cries to ring and rend and tear, regardless of how it hurts the doctrine of some friend at that point. It may not hurt his faith. You remember a psalm? "What is man that thou art mindful of him, the son of man that thou visit him? Thou hast made him a little less than the angels, and hast crowned him with honor and glory." Remember that psalm? Psalm 8. Look what Job does to it. "What is man that you make so much of him? You turn your thoughts toward him, only to punish him every morning, morning by morning, to test him hour by hour." Chapter 7, 17. "Why don't you look away for just an instant? Give him a chance to get his spit. Can't even swallow, God. If I have sinned, why do you not just kill me? You watcher." God the taskmaster, God the spy, never letting him go like a spider with a fly. "Why hast thou made me your butt? The target. Why don't you just forgive me, kill me, and get it over with? Then you'll be able to look and look and look through Sheol, and you won't be able to find me." That's the way it is, and that's how many of us would feel if we take seriously our God in our agony. So often in our agony, what we do is we fight and we scream only against ourselves or our brother, but not really against our God, who indeed understands suffering, who indeed understands agony. And if you listen to the cries of Job and read them as the Lord hangs on Calvary, something of the power of Jesus the slave, who is tormented and forsaken, comes much, much clearer. The man who goes through more than Job ever went, that somehow we might never ultimately die, but that all of our dyings might be his and with him. For God said nothing about us not dying.
The gospel promises nothing about not dying. What the gospel promises is that we don't die alone, that every dying is with him who died for us. There's a lot more that I was going to cover, but texts tend to evoke responses. Maybe I should say, give a couple of minutes for some questions before it's covered up, and I might read one more poem. The questions that some of you have. If you'd like to, for next time, I'd like to look at chapter 15 and a few other places. What we'll do next time is to talk about the question of justice and theodicy. That is, why, how can God be righteous in the face of this? How can Job preserve his integrity? How can Job bring God to court so that somehow or another we can resolve this problem of God being the oppressor and Job being the slave? Is it possible to come to court to handle it so that the innocent man can be vindicated and God can be put where he would appear to belong, as guilty? And that kind of feeling is part of our dying process too. But I think, you see, it's important that we recognize that we have not really, that when we're really in agony, we can and have a perfect right to say this kind of thing to God. That Job gives us the clue of what it means to be honest Christian, not merely saying nice things. And for many of you who are repulsed because some black person finally lets it out honestly and it hurts you and you dream about it and you toss and you say, when will it be morning? That's part of the dyings, part of the Job that you're beginning to hear coming right through our society. And Job will never die, for dyings are part of real living, deep living. And I hope that you die several times with him here at Holden.
Can I ask, in his desolation, does he consider self-destruction?
No. He wants the whole world to know who his murderer will be. Mm. He never says, I will put myself to death. Suicide is never a solution for Job. God, he says, you have got to do it. Then the earth will scream and my blood will cry out to the heavenly council and they will say, God did it. He never once contemplates suicide as a solution. That is a complete cop-out, and the problem would never be faced. You would just escape it. The point of his agony is at the point of confrontation. And escapism is in no sense the portrait of Job.
Right.
And suicide is just that.
Does this have anything to do with the Mideastern philosophy in Australia, where suicide enters into their...
Well, I suppose that if you talk about some of the Buddhist suicides, they're not the kind of suicides that you do quietly in some corner when you set fire to yourself. It's a very different kind of confrontation. It's really a life-giving and an effort to be redemptive in the process of suicide. That's a different kind of dying, yes. A very violent one that I don't think many of us could ever even contemplate. But many have in recent times in different ways, if you'll think of it. Any other questions?
Is it part of his theology that in Sheol that God will not be able to see him?
When you're in Sheol, you join the dust, and God doesn't bother people there. That's it. Go to Sheol and you become a breath, a vapor, a vanishing thought, and without any kind of flesh, without a body, you are no bother, you are nothing. The physical is totally a dimension of the being, and we have so easily extracted the mind, the soul from the body, that we've lost the total person in our Western civilization, as though being spiritual was somehow or another to be divorced from a human being. I know that was part of my problem training, you know, and you develop your mind and forget about your body. And the whole problem of ever trying to relate our theology to any kind of political or social change is that we've said, we preach the gospel to the soul, and we'll let Nixon take care of the body. And he has. All right, my time is up. I'll see you on Wednesday. Willie is going to take it tomorrow.